That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 11. Talking at Work. Institutional and Interactional Power.
This is the first of three lectures that will be moving out from the private conversation arena to the more public arena. So today's lecture is about the workplace, and then after that, I'll be looking at language in the classroom and in the very public arena of politics. So let's start here with talking at work. Talking at work, like talking in any situation, operates on the same principles as what I've been calling private speaking. So if you talk to someone whose conversational style is relatively similar to yours, the chances that your understanding of how they mean what they say are pretty good. When you talk to someone whose conversational style is relatively different, you can end up with frustration or misjudgments of each other's intentions and abilities. So, for example, two colleagues in an office talking to each other over time, one may feel that the other talks too much, the other may feel he or she isn't given a chance to talk, and of course these may be participants in the same conversation that have different conversational styles. But there are other ways that talking at work is different. In personal conversations, as we discussed earlier, we all balance the needs for power, that is hierarchical relations, who's up, who's down, and solidarity, that is connection relations, how close or distant are we. At work, however, our relative rank is in the foreground. Bosses have explicit power over subordinates. The owner of a company has explicit power over people who work for him or her. So you're not just getting information and giving information. You're being judged at every stage. And the way you're judged has a lot of implications for not only the work that gets done, but also who gets credit for what's done. The rank that's given, who's the boss, who's the subordinate, might be called institutional power. Also operating is something that we might call interactional power. In other words, the way you speak results in your having more authority, getting more credit, being listened to more in a given interaction. All aspects of conversational style come into play at work, and I want to look at some of them in this lecture from the point of view of both institutional and interactional power. All the examples that I'll be looking at in this lecture come from a book that I wrote on talking at work, and it's called Talking from 9 to 5. There's also a training video with the title Talking 9 to 5. To start out, let's look at an example of indirectness that's successful. So two people at work talk to each other. They're relatively indirect, but they share the style, and so all goes well. This is a conversation that I didn't tape record, but I overheard it. As part of my research, I was observing in this company, and I was sitting in the office with a woman whose name is Sally. So Sally was talking to me about her work when her phone rang, and the phone call was from a coworker named Marion. So Marion asked, "Sal, are you busy?" Sally said, "No." Marion said, "What are you doing?" Sally said, "Just talking to Deborah Tannen. Do you need me to cover the phone?" Marion said, "Yeah, I have to go to the accounting office." And Sally said, "I'll be right there." So this was just an insignificant, fleeting conversation. But I noticed, as I overheard it, that Marion didn't directly say, "Sally, I need you to come cover the phone." But she started with a vague kind of question, "Are you busy?" Of course, Sally was busy. She was talking to me. She was at work. She was doing something. In fact, when I discussed this example with other people at the company, they commented that employees often started with this general question, "Are you busy?" in order to broach a request. And like other examples of indirectness that I gave in an earlier lecture, the advantage of starting with this rather general question is that it allowed Sally to offer to come and cover the phones, rather than being placed in the position of being ordered to do so. So that was an example that worked well. Now I'm going to read another example of indirectness that went well that was tape recorded. And this was not a woman. This was a man talking to his secretary. Part of the research design that led to the book Talking from 9 to 5 was that I had subjects in a whole range of offices carry tape recorders and record their own conversations for a day each. So this one comes from a conversation that was recorded by the man that you'll be hearing. His name is Sid. This is how it went. Sid said, "Oh, and I was meaning to ask you about that. When I meet them Sunday, I'll have the invitation for Sunday night's activities, and also I'll have an agenda for the following day. In fact, an agenda for the following week for them, to give them. Is that right?" And Rita said, "Well, we can do that." Now, you can see already that it sounds like he's saying something that's already agreed upon, but you can tell by Rita's reaction that this is a request she's getting for the first time. And it goes on like that. So the next thing Sid said was, "So that night they can plan on, they can just look down through the agenda and see where they're going the next day, and we don't just present it to them Monday morning first thing." And Rita said, "That's a very good idea." And Sid goes on, "And if it could just be in an envelope or something for each one of them, and when I give them the invitation, I can give them also the agenda showing them what's going to happen for not only Monday, but Tuesday and Wednesday. They've got the whole 3 days laid out." And I'm skipping a couple lines here, and Rita says, "That's a very good idea. Okay, we'll see if we can have a whole lot of things for you to present to them." And Sid said, "Okay, all right, yep, that's a good idea." And now Sid is someone who I observed. I actually shadowed him and followed him around for more than a day at work and talked to the people that he worked with. And this was a fairly typical way that he communicated with his subordinates. You could describe what he's doing as indirectness because he made it sound as if he was referring to something that had already been agreed upon. But because of the institutional power, Rita was his secretary. All he had to do was give her an idea of what it was that he wanted done, and she would do it. And so he phrased it in a way that made it sound like this was something that she had already thought of. So these two examples are examples of the use of indirectness in the workplace that was successful. However, as we've seen before, when styles are not shared, the result can be miscommunication and misjudgment. And here, institutional power again plays a very big role. So an example that came to my attention, this was not one of the workplaces where I had people tape and where I shadowed them, but it was simply reported to me by the owner of a bookstore. She said that she had had kind of a misunderstanding, something she had to work out with the manager of her bookstore. She felt she had told him to do something, and he had agreed to do it, and then he hadn't done it. So when they sat down to talk about it, they were able to trace it to a conversation in which she had said to him, "The bookkeeper needs help with the billing. How would you feel about helping her out?" And he had said, "Fine." So she took that to mean, "Fine, I'll help the bookkeeper out with the billing." It turned out that the way he had intended it was, "I'll think about how I would feel about helping the bookkeeper out." He knew he was being asked to do it, but he didn't realize he was being asked to do it right away. He thought it was a much more freewheeling, open request, and that he could pretty much do it when he had time. At the time, he was a bit busy. He was going to do it sometime later. Well, I talked to the bookstore owner about a month after that, and I said, "How are things with the manager?" And she said, "Oh, fine. We don't have any problems anymore." And I said, "Aha, that's really great. Have you changed your way of telling him to do things?" And she said, "No, I communicate the same way, but now he knows how I mean it." So it was clear here that because of the interactional power, she's the one who owns the bookstore. He works for her. He's motivated to understand how she means what she says. If he doesn't become attuned to that, she can fire him. I like this example, too, because as I said in an earlier lecture, Americans in particular tend to assume that direct communication is somehow preferable, more honest than indirect communication. It's true that indirect communication can sometimes be open to misunderstanding, but this example shows it's very easy for people to become attuned to indirect communication. Any style works well so long as it's shared. So that's an example where, because of the institutional power, the subordinate was able to adapt and communication proceeded well. Now, it's an interesting phenomenon that even when communication is successful, subordinates still can risk misjudgment by people who observe the communication and are judging them. So here's another example. A college president was saying to her secretary something like, "Could you do me a favor and type this?" Now, there was no problem in her communication with the secretary. The secretary did get whatever it was typed. But in this instance, she was overheard by a member of the Board of Trustees. Well, he took her aside after that, went into the office, closed the door, and said, "Don't forget, you're the president." So the person who was observing the interaction felt that she, as president, was somehow not assuming the proper authority in the way that she was giving her secretary work to do. She told me this example in the presence of the secretary, and the secretary commented that she really liked working for this president, and part of the reason was that she liked the way she was told what to do. And this was not an isolated incident. In other companies where I observed, I saw this phenomenon more than once. I think of an example where a manager, part of the manager's job was to give people various work assignments, and she tended to go around and kind of talk to them about it. I was thinking of telling you to do this. Would that work out? Do you have time? Is this something that would work into your schedule? She was very successful in getting her job done and in communicating with the people that worked for her. But like the president, her boss overheard her talking in this way and criticized her for the way she was telling people what to do. He said, "You don't have control over the people who work for you." So this reinforces the point that I made at the beginning, that in a workplace, we're not only getting work done and exchanging information, but we're being judged at every stage. And this is where the rank comes in. So each person is judging and evaluating the person who reports to them. And so getting the work done is only part of it. Getting credit for what you've done is also a challenge. When conversational style expectations differ, you may find that you're doing a great job, but the person who's judging you doesn't realize how good a job you're doing. I'm going to move on now to another aspect of conversational style, and that would be the sequencing of information. It's something I haven't talked about at length in earlier lectures, but it's something that we do see across individual styles as well as across cultural styles. In other words, are you the sort of person who, when you're talking, starts with the main point and then moves on to something else? Or are you the sort of person who starts kind of vague and works up to the main point? This is something that can vary by culture, and there's an anthropologist named Linda Young, who is Chinese, and she has written about confusion and miscommunication that can arise in conversations between speakers of Chinese and speakers of American English, of course, speaking to each other in English. But she points out that it's quite typical for speakers of Chinese to start very generally and gradually work their way to the main point. What happens is that often the American has switched off by the time the Chinese speaker gets to the main point. Well, this may seem very exotic, but here's an example of something quite parallel happening in an American workplace. A woman had to tell a man who reports to her that his report was somewhat lacking and he needed to rewrite it. However, to save face for him, you might say, to let him know that he was appreciated, she started by saying everything that was good about the report and then moved on to telling him what he had to change. When she got the report back from him, there really wasn't very much change, so she had to tell him that. And when they talked about it, she was annoyed at him that he hadn't made the changes she felt she had asked him to make, but he was annoyed at her because he accused her of being hypocritical. He felt that she had told him his report was fine, and now she's changing her mind and telling him that it's not. They were able to trace this confusion to the way she had sequenced the information. Because she began with praise, she thought she was just laying the groundwork for what she was going to go on and say, the main point that the report had a lot of weaknesses that needed to be fixed. But he took what she started with, the praise, as the main point, and therefore took the later comments as kind of afterthoughts, something he could change but didn't really have to change because pretty much the report was great. So the sequencing of information can lead to confusion. In a previous lecture, I talked about agonism, that is, ritual opposition. You use opposition or fighting as a way of accomplishing something that may not literally be about opposition. Well, it's not unusual for some people in the workplace to use a kind of ritual agonism that you might call devil's advocate. So you're talking about an idea, someone raises the idea, And so you're going to start poking holes in it as a way of exploring that idea. Now, for some people, this really works. When somebody pokes holes in their idea, that really gets their adrenaline going and their mind becomes sharper, and it helps them prepare so that they can defend their idea to other people, helps them think about it better. Those who are not comfortable with agonism have the opposite response. If somebody starts poking holes in your idea, you think, uh-oh, it must be that they don't like my idea, so you take it literally, or they don't like me, you take it personally, and they may back down. I've talked to people who told me that they can learn over time to get used to this kind of agonism. A woman actually who was a physician, an ophthalmologist, told me she was at a conference and there was a very senior physician giving a presentation, and she really disagreed with what he was saying. She was tempted early on to disagree with him publicly, but she felt that would be disrespectful and unacceptable, and so she tried to kind of hold back. But at one point, she just was so frustrated, she just couldn't hold back anymore, and she kind of burst out her complaints and was pretty sure that that meant she was going to be in the doghouse with him from then on. And what happened was exactly the opposite. He was so thrilled by this intellectual engagement that he came up to her afterwards and said, "That was such a great interchange. Let's go out and have a beer." And that really was the beginning of a very productive working relationship. So that's a story that has a happy ending. It doesn't always have a happy ending. There are examples where people actually feel quite bitter. They feel that they raised an idea, somebody argued against it, so they thought, okay, it's not so good, they gave it up. And maybe that very person who argued against it ends up promoting it in the future. And they feel, in one case I'm thinking of, the person actually felt that this was intentional. He kind of talked her out of it so she would drop it and he could have it. And that could, of course, be the case. But I think it's also possible that arguing against it was simply playing devil's advocate. That is a linguistic ritual where you're using agonism or verbal opposition in order to explore an idea. In an earlier lecture, we talked at length about the linguistic device of apologies. Apologies, too, are very significant in the workplace. It's not at all unusual for women at work to be told, "Don't apologize, it's not your fault," and to be seen as less competent and confident than they really are because they're using ritual apologies. Just as agonism or playing devil's advocate can be a kind of linguistic ritual where you're using opposition, although you're not literally attacking the idea, apologies are also a linguistic ritual. And in particular, as I said earlier, there are many people who will say, "I'm sorry," and it's not an apology. It just means, "I'm sorry that happened." There was one company where I spent quite a lot of time. I had people record their own conversations. I studied the transcripts, and I shadowed people. And I also interviewed all the people who worked closely with the individual who had been taping him or herself. There was one example that really stood out in my mind. The person that was my target person who was recording herself was a boss. Part of my research design was to ask each person in the organization who they thought was the best and the weakest person in the group. Of course, this was all confidential. When I asked the manager, who was the target person recording herself, who was the best person in her group, there were about 7 people reporting to her. She mentioned the one woman who reported to her as the best. When I asked the peers, that is all those 7 people reporting to her, I asked all of them who's the best in the group. They all mentioned the same woman. So it seemed very clear that she was generally agreed upon to be the strongest person in the group. During the time that I was doing my research, though, the rankings had come out, and she was ranked at the bottom. She was so devastated by this that she was seriously considering quitting the company. In the end, she didn't. Well, who was responsible for those rankings? It was not her boss, but her boss's boss. And in fact, I had interviewed him, as I had everybody else in that division, and in fact, he had said to me when I asked who's the strongest that he thought she was the weakest. So that was where this misevaluation had taken place. Somehow it hadn't gotten up past her boss to her boss's boss how good she was and how strong her work was. Well, I can't be absolutely certain what it was that gave him that impression, but 2 things did happen that I was aware of that I thought might play a role. And one had to do with apologies. There was a meeting that I had observed that I recorded and also took notes at. And at that meeting, she had said, "I'm sorry," 7 times. And now none of them were literal apologies. For example, she had been at the front making some kind of presentation. She had gone back to her seat. And then she suddenly remembered something she wanted to add. And she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, there's one more thing." And so she went back. It was that kind of apology. So this could be one of the things that was giving the impression that she wasn't as competent as she really was. Something else had happened, which she told me about, that's interesting, too. And this is something that's very significant, especially in American workplaces currently. There's a lot of value placed on working in teams, but rewards don't go to teams. Rewards like raises and rankings and promotions go to individuals. So the question of who on the team is responsible for both the positive and the negative things that come out of that team is very much in question. So again, there you come into interactional power rather than institutional power. It's not given by the rank, but it's created by the ways that you use language and present yourself. Well, I heard from several people in that group about the following experience. This woman had been part of a small group that had been working on a certain project, and she had actually disagreed with the product that the group had agreed on. She hadn't thought that was the best thing to do, but that's what the group had agreed to do. When it came time to present, she had been singled out by the group to present. Not surprising, since, as I said, everybody seemed to feel she was the strongest person. Well, the boss's boss was present at that presentation. He's the one that the presentation was being made for. And as she began to present what the group had come up with, he was clearly unhappy with it, and he was asking very critical questions. Now, this puts her in an interesting position, because the results that she was presenting, which the group had come up with, were not actually the ones that she had supported. And so was she going to step out of her position as spokesperson for the group and say, "You're right, I had thought of that," and really talk to what his objections were? Or is she going to stay in her role as representative of the group? You might say it's a kind of framing issue. Is she going to position herself, frame herself as spokesperson for the group, or is she going to position herself or frame herself as simply speaking from her own perspective? She felt that it was incumbent upon her to stay in that position of representative of the group, and she tried to present that position as best she could, even though she personally didn't agree with it. And so it seemed to me very possible that that might have been one of the things that gave the boss's boss a negative impression of her. And I am only hypothesizing here, but I think that could be one of the things going on. So it's another element of interactional power, how you present yourself with regard to the team that you're working on. But I wanted to focus here on the fact that her use of apologies may have played a role in her being evaluated less positively than she should have been. Now, that's not to say that it's always best to stop apologizing. I think the key thing is whether everyone is using apologies in this way, or that you're the only one. And this gets back to the principle that I mentioned in an earlier lecture. Effects of conversational style are never a matter of an individual style in isolation, but always the interaction of all the styles that are operative in that interaction. Another linguistic device that can play a role in the workplace is ritual complaining. So if one person feels that complaining about the workplace, about the job, about the boss, about whatever, is a good way to create connection to the people that you're talking to, that could work very well if it's a workplace where ritual complaining is pretty much agreed upon and widespread. But if you're the only one who's using ritual complaining in this way, and you're working in a workplace where that's really kind of frowned upon, the ritual complaining can be mistaken for literal. And you can be seen as a truly disgruntled and somewhat difficult employee. So ritual complaining is another example of something that can have a positive or a negative effect depending on how it meshes or clashes with the conversational styles of the people that you work with. In an earlier lecture, I talked at some length about the linguistic device of asking questions. Now, remembering, in a workplace, not only are you getting work done, but you're also getting evaluated, we can look again at the use of questions. After my book, You Just Don't Understand, was published, I got a very interesting letter from a woman physician. She commented that when she was trained, she was the only woman in her group, and at one point she had gotten a negative evaluation when she was a resident. And this surprised her because she was pretty sure that she was doing very well. So she asked the supervising physician why he had given her this low rating, and he said, well, you don't know as much as the others. And she was taken aback, and she asked, what drew you to that conclusion? And he said, well, you asked so many questions. Well, this is really intriguing. She was quite certain that it was not that she knew less than the others, but that when she didn't know something, she asked the question. Her colleagues, apparently, when they didn't know something, didn't ask questions. Now, it's very interesting to wonder, is it necessarily good to ask questions or not good to ask questions? As with all elements of conversational style, there isn't one answer to that. Now, if you think of a situation where you're the patient and the resident is not certain of the dosage to prescribe, you might wish that he would ask a question rather than take a guess. But when you think from the point of view of being evaluated, sometimes it is better not to ask. And I've had very interesting comments about this from people in various workplaces. One place where I was talking to managers, a manager commented that she really was irritated when people who worked for her kept asking questions. She said, I expect them to go find the answer themselves. So the key here, again, is that in the workplace, always have to keep in mind, it isn't just getting the work done, but it's also that you're constantly getting evaluated. And that's, again, where this interactional power comes in. You're creating an image of yourself by the way you're talking. So if you're in a situation where everybody is asking questions, then asking questions is not going to count against you in any way. But if you're in a situation where others are not asking when they don't know and you are asking, you run the risk of being evaluated as knowing less because you're asking questions. Another whole arena of talk in the workplace is meetings. How often do you call somebody at a workplace and get told, he's in a meeting, she's in a meeting? Sometimes that just means they're talking to one person in their office, but people do spend very large amounts of time at meetings. And people have very different success getting heard at meetings. I have a whole chapter on this in Talking from 9 to 5 in case it interests you, but let me just say really quickly. Sometimes somebody will say something at a meeting, it's ignored, and then somebody else will say the same thing, and it's picked up, and it's a great idea, but it's his idea. Now, this is an experience that women report very frequently. In fact, I've very rarely heard women who work in a corporation or a large organization that have never had this experience. But there are many men who have the experience, too. And I'm thinking, for example, of one man who was British. When we ask, why would it happen that somebody would say something, it's ignored, and then somebody else says the same thing, and it's picked up. And again, we have to look at both institutional and interactional power. So sometimes if a high-ranking person repeats the idea, the higher-ranking person gets the credit. That's the institutional power. Sometimes it's interactional power, and that is a person may bring up the idea, but they say it in a way that is kind of understated. Here's an idea, or even sometimes undercutting it before they actually speak. I don't know if this is a great idea. It's just something that occurred to me, but. And then someone else might say it in a much more proclamatory way. Here's an idea. It's great. I know it's going to work. And they talk about it at greater length. People ask me if there's anything they can do about this. And one thing you can do is team up with somebody else and agree that if you bring up an idea and then it's attributed to someone else, your colleague will call attention to it. Hey, that was Sarah's idea, or hey, that was Manny's idea. It's a little hard to do that for yourself. Hey, that was my idea. Then you can sound a little bit whiny. So all of these are style differences that can play a significant role in the workplace. And we can look at all conversations in the workplace along the same dimensions and dynamics that we've been looking at in all the other contexts of conversational style. In other words, you have to consider the conversational style of yourself or the person you're speaking to, how those styles interact with each other. To sum up then, if we think about the role played by language and conversational style in the workplace, we can see that all the aspects of conversational style that I've talked about in earlier lectures also are at play at the workplace. So in many ways, it's just more of the same, but in some ways, it's also different because we're starting out with an organization in which institutional power is given. There are differences in rank that are going to influence how everything that is said is interpreted. And in the workplace, we have to worry not just about getting the work done, but also getting credit for what we've done. And so questions of who gets heard, who gets ahead, who gets credit are always at play. If you feel that you're not getting credit for what you've done or not advancing as quickly as you think you should, it's certainly worth taking into account whether aspects of conversational style may be playing a role. And as in all other aspects of conversational style, you have a number of choices. You can talk about conversational style, that is, address it as an issue of style. When I say I'm sorry, for example, I'm not apologizing, I'm just taking your experience into account. And sometimes it may seem to be useful to actually change your way of talking. In the next lecture, I want to take these issues of conversational style into another kind of public arena, and that is the classroom.
After listening to Lecture 11, a student posed this question to Professor Tannen. What impact does a boss have on a workplace? Let's listen to the professor's response.
Because of institutional power, every workplace is going to be very affected by the preferred style of the person in power, that is, the boss. There are bosses who feel, for example, that agonism, in other words, ritualized opposition, debate, is the best way to get everybody working at their peak. Goad them a little bit. Ask challenging questions. Maybe even insult them. Get them worked up so they really got to prove themselves. And that does work well with some people. Other people, however, are going to be stymied by that. They do their best when they're encouraged, when they're praised, when they're told that they can, when they're told they're doing a great job. It's interesting. I mean, so with management styles, with everything else, it's incumbent upon every manager to realize that people have different conversational styles. There's a tendency to think, okay, this works well with Sam, Mary, and Jason, so obviously I'm right. And if, you know, if Kevin, George, and Melissa aren't doing well, it must be there's something wrong with them. It's incumbent upon the manager to get the best work out of the people for the company. And that example I gave of the woman who clearly was the most talented person in that group, who was being misjudged by her boss's boss, that really was a failure on the part of that boss's boss. He almost really hurt his company by losing the most talented person in the group because he didn't do his job of making sure that he was correctly evaluating her abilities. And so I think it's really incumbent upon managers to be aware of conversational styles so that they can take advantage of employees and a range of employees. I mean, after all, if everybody in your organization has the same style, you're not going to service customers well who are also going to have a range of styles. So it's really important at every level, but I would say the higher you go in the organization, the more important it is to be aware of style differences.
This ends Lecture 11.